I'm like, I'm sorry, I barely showered today, so I did not have time to calculate how many ice cubes would go into Blue Glacier. This is the Exploring the National Parks podcast with Dirt in My Shoes. My name is Ash, and I'm a former park ranger and the founder of Dirt in My Shoes. I think that the parks are best seen from the trail, and I'm here to make national park trip planning easy.
And I'm John. I carry the kids on the trails, I tell stories, and notice all the things that Ash doesn't care about much, like flowers.
Join us as we show you around America's spectacular national parks.
We're sharing our favorite places, fun facts, adventures, and misadventures.
And we'll even throw in a little trip planning.
Let's start exploring. As a general rule, I kind of hate reaction videos on YouTube and stuff.
I don't get it. I know a lot of people like them. The only ones I like, so I saw one of like this girl singing a Pink song, and I really like Pink, and like Pink reacted to it, and Pink was just like, holy smokes. Wait, she's freaking out. Like, I think sometimes when it's celebrity reaction,
it's a little
I'm
more,
okay. Yeah. But if it's just like Joe Schmo down the street, like reacting to something, why are we watching this?
I know. I sometimes, even if it's something that sort of interests me, a lot of times I'll just scroll past out of spite. I hate that I'm watching someone else watching something.
It really is weird.
The reason I bring it up is because today's episode, we're back to Olympic National Park. And as I
Were you watching Twilight fan videos?
I was scrolling and I saw this video of a girl reacting to a guy explaining why Twilight is actually redneck.
Okay.
And I found it super entertaining.
I was going to say, that sounds like something I would watch.
Right. So actually, I wouldn't have come across it had it not been for the fact that it was a reaction video. So I actually looked up the original video.
But okay.
The reaction video was cut down a little bit more succinct. So that one was good. So Google Twilight is redneck. You'll find this video. But it was super funny because you just have this guy sitting in his truck. He's like, listen, Twilight is redneck for the following reasons. And he like details a few things. He's like, you've got this family of kids that are all like dating each other. That's redneck. And you got the main character, this girl, the kids are divorced, redneck. And then she gets a cool truck. Rednecks love trucks. goes, the funniest line of this video, he was recounting this one scene where Bella tells Edward, I know what you are. I'm not afraid of you. And he's like, I've heard rednecks say that.
When they're out fighting. Yeah.
The whole video, it was just awesome. It was a reaction video, so I do have to thank that, putting it in my view. But as a whole, I'm against reaction videos. But I do think that the point is taken. It's true. I do think that Twilight is somewhat redneck.
I guess it could be construed that way.
It's a way for us guys to justify watching it with our girlfriends and wives.
Okay.
So.
Yes.
Works for me.
Stick with that story.
Today, we're back at Olympic National Park, and I love Olympic National Park. It's so much fun. It's beautiful, and I'm really excited to talk about a lot of the fun facts.
I don't know how you only pared it down to 5 fun facts for this park, because I feel like literally every section you visit is going to have 5 fun facts.
Oh, it was a challenge because you have to pick and choose if you're going to limit it down, because Olympic National Park has so many distinct ecosystems and areas that are completely different from the other areas of the park. I picked and chose a little bit. So if I skipped over something that's your favorite, trust me, it was a hard decision. And I love the thing that you're probably thinking of, but I don't know. I think partially, I somewhat favorite the mountains a little bit today.
Okay.
But we're going to dive right in.
The mountains for me are the most underwhelming part of Olympic. So hopefully you're making them cool. I mean, not that they aren't cool. And I've learned some things about the mountains in Olympic that I think have made them more cool since I've learned that. But yeah, I think out of all the areas, the mountains are the least exciting for me. So we'll see what you got.
Okay. Before we dive too deep into Olympic and really start with the fun facts, I just have to say, we've talked about this a little bit before, how each national park kind of has its own flavor. And depending on who's designing the website, every national park website is subtly different. And so whoever was designing Olympics National Park was hungry. Because as I was like reading through some of the geology pages and things like that, every single analogy is about cookies. And so if you click onto the geology page for Olympic National Park, you'll see like legit pictures of someone explaining geological phenomena with Oreos. And they'll also do explain things about the sea stacks with chocolate chip cookies. And it's
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. It's like, it's almost my lunchtime, but I gotta hurry and write this down.
As I'm reading through this, I kept thinking of like, there's a scene in Despicable Me, the first one, where Gru has to sneak into Vector's house to steal the shrink ray. And so he asks Dr. Nefario to make him some cookie robots because Vector really wants to buy some Girl Scout cookies. But Mr. Nefario didn't hear what he said right. And so he makes boogie robots. And Gru just gets so disappointed. He's just like, if I can do my Gru voice, I said cookie robots. Why are you so old? It's just one of my favorite lines. And I just imagine like the superintendent of Olympic being like, I asked for a geology website, not a cookie website. Anyways, hopefully my Gru accent was up to par today. I don't think it was. But I have a question for you, Ash, to get us started.
Okay.
Did you know that Olympic National Park has a cousin?
No.
Okay. In all honesty, it probably has lots of cousins. I think all national parks probably have lots of cousins. Ways that connect them in their past, such as tectonic forces that create similar things in each park. I'll be a little bit more specific. I'll ask you a specific question. Which national park could have made much of the rock that makes up the mountains in Olympic National Park?
I mean, I would lean towards a volcanic one, maybe, because how else do you make rocks? And also, you're really close to a bunch of volcanoes, so...
Yeah.
I don't know. Somewhere along the Ring of Fire, I guess.
Yellowstone.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yellowstone. Okay. So this is fun fact number one. A large amount of the rock that makes up the Olympic mountain range came from the same volcanic source that powers the Yellowstone supervolcano, the Yellowstone hotspot.
I don't buy that.
That's so cool.
Why would it come all the way from Yellowstone? Wait, does that super volcanic force also feed the volcanoes like Mount Rainier?
Nope.
That's nearby? No, it goes under those and goes to Olympus.
So let's talk about this.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
Okay. So the Yellowstone hotspot is the source of power for the giant super volcano underneath Yellowstone, but it moves. It's not stationary. So if you listen to the Yellowstone Fun Facts episode, I'll go into detail a lot about this. You have the center of the Earth, you have the Earth's core, molten magma down in there. And there's almost like an arm reaching out from the core all the way up to the surface of the Earth. And it's this Yellowstone hotspot. And it's this direct channel where all this magma can come out to the surface from the bottom of the Earth.
Yes, I remember you talking about that in the Yellowstone one.
Okay. Now, we know that tectonic plates move. It's not very much. It's only maybe like a few inches every year. But this hot spot also moves. It's only a few inches every year, but it does move. And so as the tectonic plates move and as the hot spot moves, it creates so many cool things that happen across the landscape. It's really interesting. Well, about 55 million years ago, the Yellowstone hotspot was out in the ocean to the west of North America. And so the west coast of North America has been going through a lot of stuff. In the Joshua Tree Fun Facts, we covered a whole analogy with Minas Tirith and the battle that was there. There's some crazy stuff going on there. But in short, there was a tectonic plate between the Pacific plate and the North American plate, right?
Right.
It's a geologic force called subduction. As North America and the Pacific plate push together, this middle plate just got shoved down to the center of the Earth as North America kind of crawls over the top of it. Well, as you can imagine, this has created quite a bit of volcanic activity and tectonic chaos. So bringing this back to Yellowstone, this Yellowstone hotspot is huge and it's just underneath the surface. And so if you give it even just a little of a chance, if you show any weakness, it will blow up in your face. Well, 55 million years ago, it gave us a real show. Now, Ash, a couple of times on the podcast, you've mentioned how you really want to go to Iceland. And you've talked about how there's places in Iceland where you can actually see tectonic plates moving apart.
Yes.
What does the rift look like? Describe it for us.
It's like you have the two sides of the plate and you can tell that they've pulled apart and the middle is like almost like a canyon.
Yeah.
It looks kind of like a canyon, but like it's been stretched.
Yes, exactly. It's stretched. And at this moment, 55 million years ago, two tectonic plates were pulling apart just slightly and just enough that they created a weak spot, not knowing that the Yellowstone hotspot lie just beneath. And at that moment of weakness, boom, an eruption, honestly, beyond anything we can probably comprehend, it was huge. Magma from the depths of the Earth burst through, spewing lava and volcanic rock in incredible amounts. What's interesting is that this eruption happened at the bottom of the ocean. Because of that, we don't see ash and like evidence of this ash, the massive explosion eruption all over the face of the Earth. It kind of kept it contained and pretty well localized, which honestly just blows my mind. That'd be a pretty nice swim. It could create a pretty nice swim somewhere.
No way. It'd be like Dante's Peak. He boiled to death in the lake.
Yes.
No, thank you.
Yes, that's probably true. There was all of this magma, and just because it's underneath the ocean doesn't mean that it doesn't build up. I mean, the Hawaiian Islands are created from volcanoes that are underneath the ocean, and that's exactly what happened here. And so you've got this incredible eruption that happens underneath the ocean, and right here off the coast of North America, this volcano created its own island chain, just like the Hawaiian Islands. Now, as North America and the Pacific Plate continued to force this middle plate down back into the center of the Earth, it kind of hit a little rut. That rut was this island chain. So much of this magma, so much lava and volcanic debris came up out of this hole in the Earth to create this massive chain of islands. It actually stopped this middle tectonic plate from going underneath North America for 15 million years.
Just in that area?
I don't know how, it could have been the whole plate. I don't know exactly.
I just feel like that's frightening. The only thing that's going through my mind, honestly, like I'm like, oh yeah, that's cool. That the Yellowstone hotspot can move. I am not okay with that.
I'm explaining all this stuff and Ash is just like, this Yellowstone spot is moving underneath my house right
now. I know.
Now.
I was like, we live pretty darn close. It's I don't like that it can move. That's kind of frightening.
Yeah, it is a little bit frightening. So, and I'm sure 55 million years ago, there was some crazy stuff going on.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure you could feel that massive eruption from far away.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the ocean was probably warming a lot. I'm sure that there was a lot going on. This plate, it kept moving and it got halted. It got stopped because this island chain was so big and strong, 15 million years. And then one thing we've kind of overlooked about the process of subduction with this plate going underneath North America on the edge of it is actually scraping off the top of this other tectonic plate. And so it's kind of just like when you're scooping some ice cream and you're kind of scraping it along the top with your ice cream scoop, you have all this ice cream that builds up within the scoop. Well, that's happening at the edge of North America, right here at the Olympic Peninsula. And so you have all of this land building up that is being scraped off the top of this tectonic plate. And then it hits this massive island chain. And it can't go any further for 15 million years until finally enough pressure is put on the plate from the Pacific Plate and North America that finally subduction continues. And it actually scrapes off this island chain from the top of this tectonic plate onto this ice cream scoop, which is the Olympic Peninsula now. And that is where the Olympic Mountains come from.
Are you serious?
Yes.
It's from that plate that was going down. I just scraped off the top. That rock is the Olympic now.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. As you travel through the Olympic Mountains, you can see it like when you're at Hurricane Hill or Hurricane Ridge. If you pay attention to a lot of the mountain peaks that you're looking at, where you can see the different layers of sedimentary rock, the rock layers are a lot of times are vertical or tilted or diagonal this way or that way. And a lot of them are backwards or upside down. And it's crazy because it's just like scooping that ice cream. It's absolute chaos geologically.
I am really frustrated that we were just in Olympic last summer. And I really want to go see those mountains because I have never noticed that. I've never noticed any striations. I've never noticed any weird layers mm-hmm. or anything like that. And now I'm just kind of bugged.
Yeah.
Back to Olympic we go.
Now, what's amazing is in a lot of ways, it reminds me of the Borg from Star Trek.
John's been watching a ton of Star Trek lately. I was wondering when the Borg would show up because he's been like obsessing over the Borg or over Worf.
The Klingons.
One or the two. Yeah. Every day.
Oh, my
or
gosh.
Something.
It's so good because like the scraping off action that happens here, it happens all along the coast. That's why like from the bottom of California all the way up to the top of Washington, you'll have like these small coastal ranges of mountains. It's not unique, really, to the Olympics. What is unique is how strong and tall these mountains are. Because in a lot of ways, like North America scraping off the top of this other tectonic plate, it's like North America is saying, we are the Borg, you will be assimilated, your uniqueness will be added to our collective, resistance is futile. And so regardless of how hard this other tectonic plate tries, it's going to be taken.
Assimilated.
Yeah. And it will be added to these mountain chains.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened here at Olympic, despite the fact that this volcanic island chain was so strong and powerful. It was still added to the Borg of what is now Olympic National Park's mountain range. But it's so strong, and these mountains literally rise almost straight up out of the ocean.
They really do. Once I realized that, I was much more impressed. Because you really, when you start driving to the top of Hurricane Ridge, you're at sea level. And the mountains, they're like 8,000 feet.
Mount Olympus is 7,969 feet tall.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the whole relief of the mountain because you start pretty much at sea level.
The very bottom of Mount Olympus is only 131 feet above sea level.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're almost 8,000 feet.
Yeah. Now, this is as far as I could tell. I tried to do some research to figure out if I'm right on this. But as far as I can tell, that is the smallest gap between elevation and like the bottom of the mountain. So prominence is a term used for like how tall the mountain actually is from base to top.
Right.
131 feet, as far as I can tell, is the smallest gap between elevations and prominence of any of America's top 100 tallest peaks. But that leads us to the next chapter for these mountains, which is the carving of these awesome mountains. And fun fact number two. Fun fact number two is that Olympic National Park has over 60 named glaciers.
I was really surprised when I was looking up stuff for Olympic at how many glaciers there are in that park. Because like an 8,000 foot mountain is not like super impressive in most cases.
Yeah. It's all relative to where you are, right? Because more inland, like in Colorado and Wyoming, we're looking at mountains 14,000 feet high. But what the prominence is really what's amazing.
So, I mean, I guess I just thought like, oh, an 8,000 foot mountain, you wouldn't think. I mean, because you've got Mount Rainier just a couple hours away. And that one is, I mean, its prominence is almost its whole mountain too.
Yeah.
At like 14,000 feet. And Mount Rainier has like 28 glaciers on it. Mm-hmm. So you're like, well, yeah, but at 14,000 feet, that makes sense that there would be glaciers up there.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I learned how many glaciers Olympic actually has, it was like, no, that doesn't make sense because it's only 8,000 feet. How does it have that many glaciers?
Yeah.
Plus it's like in a coastal area. And so it does get cold, but it doesn't get like freaking cold. It's right. A lot more moderate of temperatures and stuff too. So yeah, that's a huge surprise. I'm guessing it has to do with all the rainfall.
It does. We're going to get to that. But I think one of the things I wanted to point out was that this entire area has an amazing glacier history. The biggest glacier here is Blue Glacier.
And you can see that one from Hurricane Ridge.
Yep. And that one is on Mount Olympus.
Yeah.
And it can be up to 900 feet thick.
Wow.
Which is nuts.
Yeah.
And it's 2.6 miles long. At one point, there was one researcher that calculated this. He said that it would be equivalent to 20 trillion ice cubes.
How do people have time to come up with those calculations? I know.
That's awesome.
Like, I'm sorry, I barely showered today. So I did not have time. Calculate how many ice cubes would go into Blue Glacier.
That glacier is pretty big, right? But how many ice cubes do you think that is? I'm not sure. According to my calculations, 20 trillion. So this is what I thought was really interesting. So glaciers, they carved out the entire landscape of the Olympics. And you can kind of see that. You can see these big U-shaped valleys and everything like that. But it also carved out everything around it, and glaciers, almost as much as like the Yellowstone hotspot, created so much of what's going on in this area of the world. Now, it's kind of tricky to trace this because a lot of newer glaciers erase evidence from older glaciers because they carve it all out. Once it's gone, it's gone.
Because glaciers go in cycles, and a lot of people don't realize that's how it works. Like, especially like at Glacier National Park, where everyone's like, oh, all the glaciers are going to be gone. It's like, yeah, but the glaciers you're looking at today are only 12,000 years old. Like, they're baby glaciers.
Right.
They haven't been here for nearly as long as like the overall scape of the park. So yeah, the ones you're seeing now likely are not, I mean, they're not like the carving glaciers of old that just cleared out all these huge canyons, and the one that made Lake Crescent in Olympic, for example, like that's super deep lake and it's really blue and beautiful. But like, how long has it been since a glacier has been there?
Right.
So
yeah, it's been a while, but for the most part, a lot of these bigger glaciers that did a lot of the work in the area, it was only 16 to 17,000 years ago.
Oh, really?
Is when they took over the area. And that was kind of the last major ice age chapter for this area. So what happened was there was this massive ice sheet that covered most of northern North America. But there was this little arm that extended off of that giant ice sheet that came down and headed right for the Olympic Peninsula. But what's amazing is as soon as that the ice sheet came down, it hit the Olympics, but it couldn't overcome the Olympics. And so it went like around the Olympics. And so this giant ice sheet, one of the arms, it hit the northwest side of these mountains, and then it curled just straight west. And then the other arm of it went down southeast of where the Olympics are now towards Seattle. And so that all happened between like 16 and 14,000 years ago. And this ice sheet, these arms, the ice was like 3,500 feet thick. I just think it's so crazy that as it came into the area, it hit the Olympics and couldn't take it down.
Yeah, because it was the stronger stuff.
Yes, that's exactly right. But it was these two arms of the ice sheet that carved out the Puget Sound.
Okay.
And that carved out the Strait of Juan de Fuca.
Okay, so for those of you that have not been to the area, the Puget Sound is all the water that splits like the Olympic Peninsula to the west from Seattle to the east.
Right.
So there's a whole arm of water that comes down from there, and there's a whole bunch of islands. You've got like Whidbey Island and all those islands in here. Puget Sound.
Right.
And the Strait Juan de Fuca is the one that it disconnects the Olympic Peninsula from Canada.
Right.
So it's on the northern side of the peninsula. You'll see it. I mean, that's how you get over to Victoria.
Right.
And all that stuff over there. So yeah, so you've got these two different waterways that kind of surround the Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah.
Besides the ocean on the far west.
Yes.
So yeah.
Oh, it was so cool. And I just think
so you're saying that was the ice sheet.
That was the ice sheet.
Okay.
Yeah. And so this specific ice sheet that carved out the landscape all around Olympic couldn't actually overtake or take down the Olympic Mountains.
So it made the peninsula.
It made the peninsula. Cool. Exactly. Now, just because these ice sheets couldn't take over the Olympic Peninsula doesn't mean there weren't glaciers on the Olympic Peninsula. There were tons of giant glaciers. They were just independent of this entire ice sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you can see, as you look at these mountains, you see these giant carved out valleys and these really beautiful canyons. And the remnants of those are still on the tops of these mountains. But what we have as evidence that they were here is amazing lakes. There's so many cool lakes here at Olympic National Park. So you have lakes like Lake Ozette, Lake Quinault, Lake Cushman, and Lake Crescent, which you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. These deep, beautiful lakes that are so blue. The water is so blue and it's gorgeous. They just kind of come out like fingers. Lake Crescent itself used to actually be way bigger than it is now because there was actually a landslide that cut it in half.
Because there's another lake. What is it called?
Lake Sutherland.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But that you'll pass if you're driving from Port Angeles to Lake Crescent.
Yeah.
They used to be one.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And where Granny's Cafe, where you get the ice cream.
That place is so good.
So good. Lake Crescent used to extend out all the way to there.
Okay.
And so, but Lake Crescent is officially the 14th deepest lake in the USA. And it reaches down 624 feet. And I don't know, it's just so cool. These glaciers, they couldn't take down the mountains all the way, but they did some amazing work.
Lake Crescent is one of the clearest lakes I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I am a picky lake swimmer. I don't like swimming if I can't see the bottom,
mm-hmm.
or if it's like icky on the bottom. You can feel like the seaweed or the plants mm-hmm. in between your toes.
Yeah.
You can't see the fish swimming around you, stuff like that. It's like not my favorite place to swim, but Lake Crescent is crazy because you can be out on the dock jumping in and the water is pretty deep because yeah. you can jump in from right there. How deep do you think it is? 25 feet? 20 feet?
Maybe 15 to 20 feet.
But you can see the bottom as if it's
oh,
just
yeah.
your hand in front of your face.
You can paddleboard out really far and still see perfectly to the bottom.
Yeah.
On the NPS site says that part of the reason for that is because it's a low in nitrogen lake.
Oh, well, it's the cream of the crop for lake swimming for me.
Yes.
Because it doesn't get gross and you can see the bottom for a long time.
Yeah.
So yeah, that lake is so cool. But you can tell it's glacial too. It's surrounded by mountains and
yeah.
it's really clear and it's a deep blue. And
the lakes are beautiful blue, but a lot of the rivers also kind of have that chalky bluish color coming out of them.
Yeah.
Whether it be the Elwha River or the Ho River or the few others that are just, they're all glacier fed.
And mm-hmm. it's Solduck probably too.
Yeah. They're so pretty.
Yeah.
So this is going to lead us into fun fact number three. The glaciers were all over the Olympic mountain range. But when these arms of this ice sheet came out and it surrounded the north and east side of the Olympic Peninsula, it created an island of land.
Mm-hmm.
It almost completely isolated the Olympic Peninsula from anything else. That leads to some really amazing impacts. And not only is like this land isolated geologically from a lot of other things, but it also
the plants and animals?
Yeah. It Yay. Also isolated it biologically.
Yeah, I was going to say, it probably made it interesting what stays there and lives there different than other parts nearby.
And so it isolated life on the Olympics with water on all sides. Ocean to the west and the south and ice mountains and landscape everywhere else all around it. And so for at least a few thousand years, during this last ice age, and who knows how much further back. Much of the life here evolved and adapted independent of the rest of the world around it. And it has, like I said, some incredible impacts. And this is fun fact number three. Within Olympic National Park, there are at least 16 kinds of endemic animals and 8 kinds of endemic plants. Endemic meaning that this is the only place in the world where you will find these specific creatures and plants.
Well, that's pretty cool. And also, I didn't know what endemic means, so thank you.
Yes, maybe I'll restate that. Fun fact number three is that there's at least 16 kinds of animals and 8 kinds of plants that you won't find anywhere else.
Oh my gosh, that's so much more along the lines of what I can understand. And that's crazy.
Yes.
I'm trying to think what I've seen that maybe you couldn't see anywhere else.
Well, let me just tell you, Olympic has its own slugs.
Are they the banana slugs or no?
Not the banana different slugs.
Because I was I think you can see those elsewhere.
One of them has the craziest name. It's a jumping slug, which is...
That's terrifying.
That is scary.
I do not like slugs. They're so gross.
I just feel like it's going to be like the movie Alien with that thing that jumps on you and then...
Yeah, no.
Puts its alien
in
you.
No, I do not want to see a jumping slug.
Oh my gosh. So Olympic has its own slugs, its own beetles, its own grasshoppers, butterflies, and moths. Olympic has its own fish, its own salamanders. And Olympic has its own gophers, moles, chipmunks, and marmots. Its own marmots.
I love marmots.
So those marmots that you see when you're hiking on Hurricane Hill or when you're up at Hurricane Ridge, those are the Olympic marmot, and they're totally separate from anything you see at Mount Rainier.
They're not the yellow-bellied.
Yeah.
Nope. Oh, that's cool. And The chipmunks, too. I'm trying to picture a chipmunk.
I know. And that doesn't even mention the plants. But
you know me, I don't like bugs very much. I get much more excited about the marmots. They're so cute.
I knew I would end on the high points there as I made my list. Start with jumping slugs and end with the marmot.
It was a good call.
Oh my gosh.
I got progressively more excited in that list.
But I don't know. I just think this place is so cool. It has its own independent ecosystem caused by these giant mountains that survived the invasion of this ice sheet and that created its own island of life.
What are some of the plants?
They're pretty small. Most of them are like little wildflower mosses, kind of things like that. Mm-hmm. So the NPS site listed out more of the animals because probably are more excited about that.
Yeah, I don't recognize plants very good, but interesting.
Now, what is also really interesting is what's interesting is that Olympic has things that others don't. But on the other side of that same coin, Olympic is also interesting because of what it doesn't have.
Okay.
Because being isolated also caused certain things to go missing from the Olympics that are everywhere else in the Western Mountains. Can you think of anything that you haven't seen there?
In Olympic?
Yeah. Animals.
Big ones?
Yeah.
Really?
Pika.
They don't have pika?
There's no pika.
Okay.
No ptarmigans.
Okay.
No ground squirrels. No.
Olympic doesn't have squirrels?
No ground squirrels, at least.
They have different kinds of squirrels, but not ground squirrels.
Yeah.
That's weird.
They don't have lynx or red foxes. Coyotes have kind of been reintroduced. A couple of these have been reintroduced, but historically there were no coyotes, wolverines, grizzly bears, bighorn sheep, or mountain goats.
They've been reintroducing mountain goats, right? I'm pretty sure it's mountain goats. They close Hurricane Ridge for a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. It's
almost every
year.
The
opposite. So they've been removing.
Oh, they have?
Yeah, they've been taking mountain goats
from Olympic.
They're
not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were removing them. I thought they were bringing them in.
No, what the Park Service is trying to do is they're trying to recreate this amazing isolated landscape.
Yeah, bringing it back to what it's supposed to be like.
This independent biosphere of the Olympic National Park. And so, like I said, some of these have been reintroduced, like coyotes and mountain goats. That happened maybe naturally, maybe unintentionally. But what they've been doing is they've been helicoptering a lot of these mountain goats out and taking them to places like the North Cascades.
Uh-huh. I guess I didn't realize it was that direction.
Yeah.
I knew they closed stuff down so that they could do mountain goat stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the mountain goats, they're munching on maybe some of these plants that aren't adapted to be munched on like
right.
that. And so they're taking them out, taking them other places. But I think that would be one of the hardest jobs, to chase down some of the most agile creatures on
just space. Have to have a blow dart gun or something.
Have to have a helicopter and a blow dart gun.
Yeah.
I like that idea. I would love to see Ash with a blow dart sitting on the side of a helicopter with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Get into the chopper. I don't know, that would be pretty awesome.
It would be disastrous if I was in charge. That's for sure. I don't like getting close to animals in the first place. They kind of scare me.
Oh my gosh. Not only geologically, but biologically, this place is just so interesting. It's so cool. And it's set apart from even places right across the Puget Sound or right across in Canada. This place, at different chapters in its history, has been its own microcosm of life, and it evolved that way. And I just think it's super cool. Now we're going to get into something that you mentioned earlier, which is so crazy.
All the rain?
Yeah, the rain.
Okay.
We come from Utah, and Utah gets somewhere between 8 and 13 inches of rain a year. Fun fact number 4 is that there are parts of Olympic National Park that get between 140 and 167 inches of rain every year.
12 to 14 feet. It's so crazy.
We get in inches what they get in feet of rain.
We don't even get in inches what they get in feet most years.
I know. That's so crazy. It's incredible. And that has some amazing ramifications as well. And I love the way that the National Park site says this. The lush forests in the Quinault, Queets, Ho, and Bogachiel Valleys are some of the most spectacular examples of primeval temperate rainforests in the lower 48.
Primeval?
Primeval.
What do they mean?
Just means like ancient world.
That's a great word.
Yeah.
We should use primeval more often.
I know. It's so good. So when you come to Olympic National Park and you set foot in the Ho Rainforest or the Quinault Rainforest, one of these temperate rainforests, you are stepping back into ancient earth.
And all of those are on the west side of the park near Forks.
Right.
Pretty much. So you've gone out of the mountainous area of Hurricane Ridge and gone around past Lake Crescent over to where the beaches and stuff are, which makes sense for getting so much rain because it's a rain shadow effect right there. So
right.
that all of those places are on the west side of the Olympic Range. So it's stopping all the water, dropping it right there.
Right.
And that's why they get so much water. And that's where the temperate rainforests are.
Now, historically, these primeval rainforests historically stretched from like southern Oregon all the way up well into Alaska. And around the world, there are other examples of temperate rainforests like this, but very few of them now remain outside of protected areas. There's some in like Chile and New Zealand and southern Australia. But this is a pretty rare occurrence to have a temperate rainforest like this. And you can easily access it here in Olympic National Park.
That's why the lines to get into the Ho are 2 hours.
Yes, exactly.
It's a primeval rainforest.
Yeah, man. We're all excited. We just think it's so cool. And it is so cool. So the fact that these are rare, they're primeval, you're going to see something here that you can't see other places. And the ingredients to create a temperate rainforest like this, I mean, you have to have tons of rain, moderate temperatures, you've got to have old trees, and you have to have what I think is a really fun word to say, epiphytes, plants that just grow on top of other plants.
Oh, okay.
And so that's okay. where all that carpet. Yeah, all of this, these mosses and these lichens that just grow on top of everything that it can find.
It really is so impressive. And I think what makes it cooler is how old the trees are in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're like 1,000-year-old trees.
Yeah.
So you're not looking at little baby trees.
No.
Back in here. You're looking at these just massive giant trees that are so old. And then they have, it's as if someone rolled out a rug over each of their branches, like a big fuzzy rug.
Yeah. A lot of these trees were born in primeval times.
Yeah, it's really impressive.
A lot of the conifers, a lot of the pine trees are more than 20 stories tall. They're so big. Now, this was really cool. And I think this is specifically thanks to these temperate rainforests that over 1,450 types of vascular plants grow on the peninsula, nearly the same number as the British Isles, meaning all the UK, Ireland, England, Scotland, it's an area 30 times larger than the Olympic Peninsula.
That gets a lot of rain.
Yeah. And this place has as many types of plants that are specific to rainy places as England.
Interesting. You know what else is impressive about these rainforests?
What?
The sheer number of mosquitoes. Don't forget your bug spray.
Yes. They are not specific Olympic mosquitoes, so feel free to slap and smash and smush.
It was almost like Alaska last time I was there. It was like I was trying to record a video and I would like smack my forehead and have like 10 mosquitoes on my hand.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's true. They were eating us alive this last time, which is crazy. Okay, we're going to leave the scientific fun facts for a minute. We're going to head into the human history because I think there's a really interesting aspect to Olympic National Park in terms of the human history. And I love explorers. Fun fact number 5 is that the Olympic Peninsula itself was one of the last places explored and mapped in the lower 48.
It's so crazy.
And honestly, it makes a heck of a lot of sense when you think about how rugged this place is. I mean, you've got giant mountains that have been isolated and carved out by glaciers. So you've got glaciers, you've got mountains, you have primeval rainforests that are almost impenetrable. And then you've got this world is almost its own place. And it's trying to keep everything out is what it feels like in a lot of ways.
And it did a really good job because, as I recall, when I was looking up stuff for Olympic on Dirt in My Shoes, like it was not that long ago when it was finally mapped.
No, it's actually kind of crazy because Lewis and Clark, they made it out to the Pacific Ocean in 1804, 1805. That was their dates. But in 1885, the newspapers around Seattle were like begging for someone to take up the banner and go through Olympic National Park, the Olympic range of mountains, and explore it and map it. There was a bunch of the newspapers were like begging for someone to do it. 1885, an expedition was set and they're like, okay, we're going to do this. And they went out and they started kind of making their way through part of it. But that expedition failed. And so for like the next few years, a renewed call came from a lot of these newspapers in Seattle. We need to do this. We need to explore the mountains right across the bay from us. How can this be so difficult? And in 1889, John Christie answered the call of these Seattle newspapers to explore the area. I don't know why he chose this time, but in December of 1889, they called their expedition the press trip because it was funded by these newspapers, by the press. And so the press trip entered the Olympic Mountains and started with the Elwha Valley area in December.
Yeah, December doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, December of 1889. And it says that it was like the most snowy and most miserable winter. Jeez. And so they kind of explored in through there. They lost track of these guys for a little while. And so they entered in December. They finally made it to the coast, kind of out by Lake Quinault and stuff like that, in May. When they got to the ocean, they were like tattered and torn and low on food and supplies. And they were just like, they made it out to the ocean and they finally made it there 6 months and they didn't even map everything. But it took them that long to get through this Olympic wilderness. And that's really is it's just this primeval wilderness. And it's really crazy. And I don't know, I just thought that was super cool that this was one of the last places in the lower 48 to be explored and formidable to a lot of people. A lot of the early settlers didn't even stick around. People may have been like, yay, free land, but they got there, realized how hard it was to live here, and then they left. And so this place is crazy.
I wonder why it's so hard. I mean, I'm trying to think. I guess maybe the mountains are just really steep.
I wonder if it's partly that so much of the landscape is somewhat volcanic, and so maybe it wasn't as fertile, but also all the rain, I think it probably would flood all your crops.
Wait, no, I mean, like, why it took them so long to map it.
Oh, to map it.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know. It just, maybe.
Like, what was so impenetrable about it, I guess, is my question. Or if it just looked really scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so interesting. I think that we see the land so differently than they did back then. A lot of the people who approached it in the 19th, 17th, and 16th centuries approached by boat, and they saw just this enormous wilderness towering above them. But now when we go, it's so easy to access. You know, we drive, but even all of our roads don't even
penetrate. The roads don't even go through Olympic.
Yeah.
They go around. And that's what's really crazy about that park, which we talked about in the exploring episode. And why my Olympic itinerary on Dirt in My Shoes helps so much is because there's no roads that go through Olympic. You're driving around it and then going in for a few miles until you can't go in anymore,
right,
except on foot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just an interesting thing to think about. I think you're right, though, where we don't see the park as it was when it was discovered and when people were first getting to the area and living in the area and stuff like that. It looks vastly different now.
Yeah. And I think most of the people that drive to Olympic National Park drive into it the same way we did. They go in through Squim or they come up and around along the 101. But when you do that, you do not get to appreciate the Olympic Peninsula in the same way that these people did so many centuries ago and for such a long time, because there's only one place I feel like that you can actually do that. And if you go through to Port Angeles and you go out onto the Eda's Hook and you can kind of see the Olympic Peninsula like a lot of these seafaring men would have and a lot of these early settlers and explorers would have, because you can see, you're no longer blinded by all of these trees that surround you. You can actually see the landscape, and it literally just rises up out of the depths of the ocean to amazing heights covered in glaciers. And then the whole landscape is covered in temperate rainforests that are primeval and hard to get through.
Yeah.
And so we see it totally differently. And even these people in the early 1900s, I mean, the car, the automobile was still pretty brand new at this point. And so everybody's moving around with horses and carriages and wagons and things like that. And I think it would have just been such an incredible challenge to get an expedition in and out safely. And this first expedition definitely is the perfect example of like going into the wilderness and barely making it out alive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's cool.
So for your task today, we want to hear from you. What national park, because we just talked about how Olympic looks very different now than it did before and why it was so hard to map.
Mm-hmm.
What national park would you like to see in like its natural state?
Yeah. If you would be the first person to see this place.
Yeah. Like I have some ideas in my mind of what parks I would love to see, like without infrastructure and roads and stuff like that. But I think Olympic would just be amazing in that way. So head over to the Dirt in My Shoes Instagram or Facebook page. We'll have a post there for you to chime in. But we'd love to hear which national park you would love to see without anything there, as the early explorers would have seen it.
Yeah. I wonder which one I'm going to put.
Yeah. We'll chime in too.
If you wouldn't mind, please give the Exploring the National Parks podcast a 5-star review. We love hearing from you. It's a lot of fun. And please go out and get some dirt in your shoes.